impurities out. So you've got 100%, or as close as you can get, pure gold, and then you can find its properties. In the same way, you have to have a pure mind. By that I mean the mind and no other senses, no other traces. Just mind, 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 mind. No other seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting or touching. And then you get to know its properties. And one of the insights which comes up after the jhanas, when you've had lots of experience of them, is actually know what this mind is. And then when you see this common experience, you know what are you doing right now? What you actually see is seen a different way, because what's actually happening is you see something, and then immediately afterwards the mind knows it's seen. And then you may hear something. Immediately afterwards the mind knows it's heard. You may sort of feel a sensation in the body. You don't just feel it. Afterwards you know you felt it. So all these five senses, what they actually are is a sense object of the five senses followed by the mind. And that answered a question which was always bothering me. What is there in common between seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch? Why is it that it seems to be, you'll call that consciousness, when actually seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching is a discrete phenomena, even registered in different places in the brain? What connects them? What makes them similar? What makes them similar is that every one of those sense experiences is followed by a moment of knowing. And I use this, what I call the fruit simile. The fruit salad simile. So I compared like a moment of seeing to be like an apple. Apple of the eye. So hearing as a cauliflower. Because, when you get your ears bashed, you get cauliflower ears. Smelling, I had that like a banana. Because some people's noses are as long as bananas. Especially Westerners. And taste. I said a mango because I like mangoes. Yes, like mangoes. And physical touch. What do they use for physical touch? Forget now. So, I don't know. They say it's an orange. And lastly, the mind, coconut. So actually, in this fruit salad symbol, what happens? On your plate, you have an apple. And immediately the apple disappears and is followed by a coconut. And then the coconut disappears and is followed by, say, a banana. And the banana disappears, followed by a coconut. It's always followed by a coconut. So every different sense experience is followed by another one, which is the mind. And so what actually you take as seeing is not seeing, it's seeing plus knowing. What you take as smelling is not smelling, it's smelling plus knowing. What you take as, say, tasting is taste plus knowing. So because the mind is added to each one of these consciousnesses, and that's what you see, it gives the illusion of continuity. And that continuity of the knower is one of the reasons why we take this thing to be me, to be a self. This is me. But once you actually start to see and separate out from the knower, it becomes the simile of the beach. If you look at a beach from a distance, it seems to be a continuous line of sand. If you go closer, you see it's not continuous at all. It's discrete little particles of silica. If you really look very close, maybe with a magnifying glass or a microscope better, you see that those little particles of sand aren't even touching. There's a space between them. Small, but it's there. It's the same with the moments of consciousness. From a distance, ordinary mindfulness, it seems to be a continuous stream of consciousness without any breaks, except maybe when you're sleepy or whatever. But it seems continuous, which gives the illusion of this is a continuous flow, and that's me. When you start to see the breaks between them, then it's not a flow, but just individual particles, like particles of sand. That starts to challenge and eventually destroy the illusion of a continuity. You are not the knower. And all this idea of consciousness, all it is one moment of consciousness, and it totally vanishes, and another one comes up, and it totally vanishes, leaving no residue, and another one comes up and totally vanishes. And just realize what this consciousness really is, a process rather than a thing, a thing which really does rise and fall. Which comes to the The other lies a little piece of insight, a different way of seeing things which become very strong because you've had these powerful experiences which challenge, you know, what you've assumed to the core. And that is the whole idea of this anicca, which most people always call impermanence, rise and fall. It does not mean rise and fall. Even in the Satipatthana, whether it's all, you know, you see the rise and fall of, you know, the four focuses of mindfulness. I call them the four focuses of mindfulness, you know, which is body or things, and feelings and mind objects or dhammas. Even there, if you actually look for yourselves in the Sanyutta Nikaya, it doesn't mean rise and fall. It means the cause for these things arising and their disappearance. So vaya dhamma. Vaya means disappearing, vanishing, going. So it doesn't mean things rising and falling. It means seeing their cause, where they come from, and seeing them totally disappear. I don't know why the people who talk about the Satipatthana don't quote the suttas. They don't go and see the Satipatthana Sanyutta. It's a great place to understand the Satipatthana and actually understand a bit of the Pali. The vaya means vanishing, going. So you see it rising, and the rising is the cause. Where it comes from, why it's there, and also to see it vanishing. And that's what anicca is, to see something which was always there totally disappear. And a simile which I love to give is seeing the TV set. And your TV set has got 6 channels. It's an old one, not like these 100,000 channels which you get these days. It's only got 6 channels. And those 6 channels are sight channel, sound channel, smell channel, taste channel, feeling channel, and knowing channel. The 6 channels on your TV set. And yeah, you can see them switch from channel to channel. Yeah, you can see that. And you can see, you know, them rise and fall. You know, sights come, sights go, sounds come and go. You can see all of that. Yeah, that's actually easy. You can see knowing one thing and knowing something else. Yeah, you can see that. But in this simile, when the real experience of anicca is there, you see sitting watching the TV, and then you turn off all the 5 channels, so you've just got the 6th channel of the mind. And then you see the TV set disappear. Not the channels come and go, but the whole set on which your conscious experience is played out on totally vanishes. And if you think you've been scared yet, scared so far, you ain't seen nothing yet. This is... This is going to scare all the defilements out of you. But this is what actually happens. I mean, these things are really blowing your mind. Things which you don't expect. Like the tadpole getting up on the outside of the water. I've never had that experience before. Totally different. Weird. It's also one of the reasons why sometimes in meditation, when you first get to a weird state, you can't make sense of it. Reason is because you've never been there before. I mean, it's totally different. All of your ways, your reference points are all gone. You've got to find some new ones, which is why it's great listening to talks like this. This is why I give them. I've given you reference points. You may not have got there yet, but one day you will. And when you get there, then you recognize what I've been talking about. The same way I could only recognize what Ajahn Chah was talking about. When you get to these stages, say, those are the reference points. That's what he was talking about. Because you can't get there until, you can't understand that until you get there. But I'm giving the reference points to begin with. So when you do get into weird states, after a while, you get to understand them. I give you the language, the concepts, the reference points. Because this is strange, it is weird, it's nothing like you've known before, like you're in a different world. Totally. That's disconcerting, but it's also so peaceful. There's something about the human being. Everybody seems to, this is weird, but you know it's really, it's got what you call, the Buddha called the vimutti rasa, the taste of freedom. The taste of freedom is always there, so you recognize that this is scary, but this is truth. This is what I've always been seeking. This is really, really important. So usually you just get in there and just investigate, and after a while you understand what it really means. So sometimes everything disappears. And when it disappears, you recognize this thing couldn't have been anything part of me before. You understand what consciousness truly is, what anicca is. Anicca is not just things rising and falling. This is so easy. That doesn't challenge you. But it's when they totally vanish. And they're gone. things which were always there are no longer gone. And the other of the great things, I mean, you don't have to do this. It just happens. Anyone who's had a very deep meditation experience, they keep coming and telling it to me, and they can't forget it. You know, there's things like, you know, trauma. Now, a traumatic experience is when maybe you've had a car accident or you fell off a roof or something, and it's been so scary, it leaves an indelible memory in your mind. Some people need to go to psychiatrists to try and get rid of that painful memory. But those types of memories are not just unpleasant ones. Very heavy, pleasurable memories, profound memories, they also leave an indelible imprint. They haven't got a name because trauma means negative. You know, if you can get a word which is exactly the same power on your memory, leaves exactly the same imprint, but is entirely pleasurable and interesting. And that's what I'm talking about when you get deep meditation experiences. You can't forget them. They're there for you. And every time you want to look at them, they're there. And that's where you can examine those things. And they're so strong that you just can't avoid. You can't resist. You can't say no to them. You have to investigate and know them. The most important thing of your life. And that's where the insight happens naturally. As the Buddha once said, a person who has, say, got into jhana, they don't need to form the intention. They don't need to will. Oh, may I now see things as they truly are. It's natural. The word is dhammata, from where the Thais get the word tamada. Dhammata means it's of nature. It has to happen. You know, you don't need to think, oh, now I must do vipassana. You can't stop yourself doing it. It's totally automatic. And this is actually what happens. You see these experiences, they're powerful, you investigate them, and you see, my goodness, that which I thought was will is no longer there. Now I know what will is. The consciousness, you can actually see what mind consciousness, what the other consciousnesses are. You can see they're particular, they're discrete, they're not a flow. There's gaps between them, and now mind disappears, now it's sight. When I'm seeing something, I'm not knowing it. Now I know it straight afterwards. And I also, answers a question which I've seen in philosophy books so often. You know, that the reason why you exist is because you know. That is wrong. You don't know you know, you know you knew. In other words, you have a mind experience, you know something, and the next moment you know that you knew. And that is the illusion of the continuity of this knower. If you actually see that and understand what I'm talking about, it's like coconut disappears, another coconut disappears, another coconut. There's gaps between it. And that's actually the illusion. We take it to be continuous, but it's very discrete, and things vanish. But even though these things are scary, you always remember them. And one of the other reasons you remember, one of the qualities, when you always have a deep, powerful experience, what they call spiritual experiences, jhanas or whatever, is they're entirely pleasant and blissful. Sometimes the joy of them just really blows you away. And of course, you know, you've heard me tell the story that, you know, when I first got my first deep meditation, when I was still a layperson, on a retreat like this. That's why I don't mind teaching retreats, because I went on a retreat like this and I just changed my whole life, made me a monk. I had a girlfriend at the time. I left her in Gloucester. I was sleeping with her, you know, having sex, good sex. And I don't mind saying that, because look, sometimes people think that monks are some aliens from another planet. They're not like the rest of us. But the weird thing was, about 3 or 4 days later, I was sitting in this boarding house in Cambridge on this retreat and getting into these incredible meditations. And afterwards, what came into my mind when I emerged from this, you know, the bliss was incredible. And you know, the first thing I felt like doing was grabbing hold of this teacher's feet and just kissing them. He had so much gratitude and just love. You know, you've just given me this incredible gift. It's the only way that, you know, you could imagine expressing your gratitude. So if any of you get a deep meditation here, don't do that to me. Keep off my feet, you might catch something. And the next thing, of course, you was wondering, you know, when you went back to your room, you said, what the hell was that? And that was better than sex. And I say that because that was, I had sex a few days ago. And now you're having this bliss, which was far better. And as one of the people said, look, no, Ajahn Brahm, yeah, I understand what you mean, but you're demeaning. You're demeaning the power of those blisses. And I agree with you there. But that's the only real way. It's, you know, not just much better than sex. It's in another universe. Sex is just nothing. A tiny, tiny little bit. And this beautiful bliss of these jhanas and stuff is way, 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 way bigger. And so it's, you understand, what the heck was that? And you also, why? Why was that so pleasurable? So long lasting, so stable. That's the trouble with sex, it's very unstable. And it's very exciting, up and down, whatever. But the bliss of meditation is high and it stays up there for a long period of time without any effort. So what actually was that? And then, you know, after years and years, you can't forget those experiences, repeating them and having fun with them. Why is this so much happiness? And that's where you understand Four Noble Truths. It's happiness because some big amount of suffering has ended. Something which was missing. It's not just when the frog gets out of the water, you realize, oh, something is missing. What's missing was suffering. Or a huge amount of suffering. So when the tadpole becomes a frog and jumps out of the lake, it's outside of the water, but it's still wet on the outside. So it's still got some suffering left, but a huge amount is absolutely gone. And you realize that water is suffering. Now you can't imagine that at all. And when sometimes I'm careful to talk like that, because people say, you monks are really weird. What do you mean life is suffering? I have a good time. I watch some movies. I have sex. I have a wonderful family, beautiful kids. You know, I'm having a good job. I'm enjoying my life. What do you mean, you know, life is suffering? You monks, you should get a life. You're weird. It's just negative. Go and get some counseling. Life is wonderful. Life is lovely. You're just depressed. That's what it is. Monks are all depressed. That's why they say life is suffering. Life is suffering. Maybe just give me some Valium and then I'll be different. No, of course, that's not the case. What you're actually seeing is something very, very, very profound. Because that's what you do. You know, you get into a first jhana. And afterwards, you know, within the jhana, you can't do anything. You're still, you're frozen. When you come out afterwards, the memory is so strong. What is that? Why was that? And then you can think. And then you think that that was bliss. Why? And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that it's bliss because the pain which has disappeared was this body and its five senses. These senses, the Buddha said, are like on fire. Fire burns, it hurts. In fact, people tell me that the worst pain a human being can actually have is being burnt. And they may not be absolutely true, but it's one of the very worst pains to endure, you know, burns. But you're so used to burning, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching, you've got used to it. You don't notice it's pain anymore. Just like some people have had these headaches for years and years and years, and they've grown up with it, they've got used to it, they know nothing else. They just adapt to it, they don't feel it, because it's always there. And then one day someone gives you a magic pill, and it's gone. You don't feel any pain anymore. Wow! Bliss. That's exactly what happens when you get into the jhana. This body, which the Buddha always said, you read in the suttas, I'm giving you the tough teachings now, always said it's suffering, it's pain. But you don't know that. You can believe it, you have faith in it, but a lot of times you're in denial to it. But when it disappears, ooh, you're having a great time. Another occasion when people get to know that, it's close to jhana, but not quite jhana. It has similarities, enough similarities to give you a taste of what I mean. And not that many people get jhanas, but many people have this experience, which are the near-death experiences. People floating out of their body. And everybody who floats out of their body had those experiences, describes it as the most wonderful, peaceful, beautiful experience of their life. They're having a great time. And the classic story, which I read in one of these books, was of this woman, you know, having an operation, and operation went wrong. There's always complications. And so she died. And she left her body And it was so nice, floating about the hospital, having a great time. But then she met this spirit. And the spirit said, you know, the classic story, I'm sorry, but, you know, you're not supposed to die, you've got to go back. You know, you've heard that's a classic near-death experience. That's why they come back and they say, no, I wasn't meant to die, so I had to come back again. But this woman, you know, she had attitude. So she told his spirit, no, I don't want to go back. And the spirit said, but you have to, you're not meant to die. He said, I don't care, I'm not going, this is too much fun. And they had this, what she described, because she did come back afterwards, she described it as like this argument on the astral plane with his spirit. You've got to go back. No way. But you have to. You can't force me. And in the end, she said, very, very quickly, so she couldn't avoid it, the spirit grabbed hold of her and threw her back into her body on the operating table. And that's how she came back. And she said, she's so pissed off at that spirit. She's so angry. And she said in this interview, when I die next time, we all die, I'm going to find that guy. And you wouldn't believe what I'm going to do to that guy. What he did to me, putting me back in this body which sucks. Never again. I'm going to tell that guy off. I'm going to find him, whatever I do. She was going to exert revenge. But the funny part of that story was, you know, it really emphasized the fact that sort of being in this body is pain. All the time. It's just some days are more pain than others. And all those times you think it's beautiful, all those times you're sitting having your breakfast, this delicious meal, it's nice and peaceful, you just watch the beautiful forest. And life is wonderful, life is peaceful, and you think, oh, this is bliss, just being in Jhana Grove, no worries, nothing to do, just having a nice breakfast, being entertained afterwards from 8 till 9 and in the evening. But if you get into jhana, sorry, that sucks. Even the most beautiful sunsets just fade when you know something better. Now, you probably know why some monks and nuns become monks and nuns. When you can taste something more delicious, why do you want rubbish food? That's why you stay as a monk. Who wants sex? Even the best sex. Movies, traveling around the world. Who wants that when you've got something you can just close your eyes and really bliss out to the bliss better than sex? Way beyond. Now, this is not to try to create your desires. It's just saying why a person can understand the truth, what suffering is and what suffering is not. The dukkha, the burden, the heaviness, the weight. And after a while, you go deep into the jhanas. And it's not just the body disappears. The next thing which really disappears, and this is the second jhana, is the will. In the first jhana, there's just a tiny smidgen of will left. The second jhana, it totally goes. And that's when the tadpole, or now the fork, realizes, now I know what will is. And you know, the will is actually pain and suffering. It's a torturer. You can't understand just how much pain and suffering your will has caused you and is causing you right now. It's this tormentor, always on at you. It's just like this fly which is in your nose and never goes away. Now, you've had flies always irritating you, so you can never be still. Maybe you find a nice place to meditate, you're getting peace, and it's in your eyes. It really irritates and never lets you be still or peaceful. That's your will. It's always buzzing around in your brain, making you do things. Always sort of giving you things to think about, to work on, to project, you know, to do projects, to come here, to go here. I've got to figure out Dharma. I've got to meditate. I've got to do this. That's your will. That's enemy number one. The irritating fly, you know, between your ears. I don't know how it's got in there, but now it's in there. It buzzes around all the time. And one day, the fly stops buzzing. Peace at last. I don't have to move anymore. Don't have to think. Don't have to do anything. Rest. Imagine just, have you ever rested? Really rested? You don't know what rest is until you've got to the second jhana. You've always been moving. That's why you're always tired. It's one of the reasons why you get angry. It's understandable. You're just so tired. I don't mean just sleeping. I mean your mind has always been moving. You're not body tired, your mind is exhausted. All the stuff you've done in your lifetimes. You get into a jhana. Yes, at last. That is bliss. You know, another level of bliss beyond letting the body go. And now you're understanding what the Buddha meant by the Four Noble Truths. Things which you never thought were suffering. Things which you thought you could cherish and delight in. Things which you thought were your friend, your will, part of you. Now you realize he's a great deceiver. One of the great stories of the Buddha, one of my favorites. And again, he used these similes from the daily life of India in those days to convey the same message. He said that one day this salesman came to a village. He was a bit of a con artist. And he was selling these clothes, these cloth to all these villagers. And he, in those days, the finest cloth was called Benares cloth. It was like the Versace Gucci of India at that time. And he was selling all this cloth, and this blind man came up and said, "I want some too." And so the con artist saw his chance. He said, "I've got some special Versace cloth for you." But the guy couldn't see it. So actually what he really gave him was this oily, dirty old rag. He said, "But this is special. This is a designer cloth. Now wear it." And so the blind man paid a lot of money for this, and he wore this and went around, you know, feeling, "I got a designer cloth too." But really, it was an oily rag. He knew he'd been dudded. It was a fraud. But a week later, so a doctor came to the village, you know, from the Fred Hollows Foundation, and said, "I can actually cure people's eyesight." And so he volunteered, and his eyes were cured. He could see again. "Oh, great, I can see again. Hang on. What am I wearing? I'm wearing an oily rag. And that con artist, he told me it was an expensive cloth." And he'll be very upset when he finds out. And that's what the Buddha said about this body and this will. You have been sold an oily rag. And you think, "Oh, it's a nice body. Look at my body. I'm beautiful. I'm strong. I'm fat." "Actually, I'm not fat, because no, my problem, I found it, I read it in a dictionary. My problem is I've got anorexia." It's true, because I read in a book. The definition of anorexia is you look in a mirror and you think you're fat. That's me. Now I understand. Look it up. So there's a few other anorexics here. Oh, anyway, back to sort of serious stuff. I was supposed to be serious, sorry. So, that's actually, you've been sold something which is not true. And the only way you can find that out is to get your sight back. Get into some powerful meditations where you really get big insights. The Buddha said again and again, not in one sutta, maybe 100, 200 times, "Samadhi pachaya yata bhutayana dasana." The stillness, the jhanas, are the cause for seeing things as they truly are. Not sati, samadhi pachaya yata bhutayana dasana. Not mindfulness, but samadhi, stillness, jhanas. That is the cause for seeing things as they truly are. This is what happens. You see these things. The result of this, something happens. You get enlightened. Your eyes, your blindness is cured. And you see that such many things which you cherish are just oily old cloths. You've been sold a dud by that salesman Mara. Goes around selling all these stupid things. And now you see that, it changes your life. So anyone who really has a path and fruit, it's not just, "Oh, now I'm smart, now I'm wise." It changes you, become a different person. just the way you think, the way you act. And the example of that, again, one of my similes, which I love to say, is the simile of the driverless bus. And I use a very, very common metaphor for life, as life as a journey. It's not the destination, it's the journey, that's life. And so I said, life is like a bus journey. But sometimes your bus journey is very, very unpleasant. Sometimes your bus driver goes through very unpleasant territory, toxic waste dumps, industrial areas which have declined after the GFC, places which are degrading, you know, the slums of the cities in the world. Unpleasant places, and no one likes to see unpleasant toxic waste dumps or slums or decaying industrial areas, because it's unpleasant to see. So you tell your bus driver, speed up, get out of here. And what does your bus driver do? Slows down and parks. Now this is a metaphor for life. You know, sometimes you have unpleasant experiences in life. Pains, divorces, financial problems, great sicknesses. Haven't you ever noticed they last longer than they should? Why does it always last so long? And other times your bus driver is driving this beautiful scenery with these mountains and waterfalls and beautiful rolling meadows and everything, and seascape, and everything is so beautiful and lovely. And you say, slow down, I really want to enjoy this. And what does your bus driver do? Accelerate. So when you are having a good time, it just goes so fast. It's already Friday, only a couple of days left, it's gone so fast. Slow down, bus driver. And he puts his foot on the accelerator and speeds up. So the happy moments in your life, they don't last as long as they should. And so for most people, they come to a place like this. They go to a church, they go and see wise people to train their bus driver to be smarter, so that you can enjoy the happiness of the world longer and longer and longer. And whenever there's any pain and suffering, find these skillful means to get out quicker. Ways of dealing with depression and anger and pain. You know, come here, Ajahn Brahm, can you please tell me how to let go of my anxiety so I don't need to suffer? But no one ever comes here and say, Ajahn Brahm, can you teach me to let go of my happiness? You want more of that and less of the suffering. So a lot of times, people's idea of the spiritual life is to train their bus driver to be wise, to be smart, to have all these skillful means, so less suffering, more happiness. But if you're going to train the bus driver, you've got to find where the bus driver is, first of all. Just like in your bus, you have to get up off your seat where you're sitting and go and find the bus driver's seat, so you can actually tell him or her or it, whatever it is, come on, when it's painful, accelerate. When it's pleasant, slow down, okay? And these are all the tips which I've heard at the temple to do this. So you're going to try and make your will smarter. And that's what most people do. But what happens eventually, you know, you've got to find the bus driver's seat. And that's what you do in meditation. You go in, because that's where your bus driver is, right inside. In the present moment, into the silence, into the breath, into the nimitta, into the mind. That's where you find your bus driver. Inside. When you finally get deep enough, it's like you finally walk to the front of the bus and see the bus driver's seat. And that's when you get insight. One of the biggest shocks of your life. The thing which does turn you around and give you some enlightenment experience. You find personal experience right in front of you, can't deny it. The bus driver's seat is empty. No one there. Oh my God. There is no will there. This bus is automatic. And then what you do, you see non-self. There's only one thing you have to do. Just go and sit back in your seat and stop complaining. No desire, no ill will. You just take it on the chin. Because there's no one to complain to anymore. No guilt. No fear. No one there. The emptiness of no bus driver. And that's weird. Okay, it shocks you, first of all. I'm just giving you some sort of description. It's not quite like that, but you understand what I mean if you get there. The empty bus driver seat. And those are the things which make you enlightened. But I should actually say on this enlightenment talk, how you actually get these paths and fruit, first of all. There's another great simile which I developed. Bus driver's seat. These are original Ajahn Brahms. I invented these. I got the franchise. Because a lot of times, I mean, you're a Western monk, and you have these experiences, you have these ideas of how the hell can I explain this to people? So sometimes, you know, you have to innovate, just let your mind run, and just see some nice similes. And this simile was one of the classic ones of how to become enlightened. And it's not just giving you a talk on what enlightenment is, but actually how you get there gives you a good idea what enlightenment is. This is the marvelous simile, it's one of the best, of the donkey and the carrot. And it's a classic, but it's powerful, because it shows you what you should do to meditate, and also how to meditate, and what happens, and why. Donkeys are notorious for being stubborn. They're not quite as stubborn as you are. You know you're stubborn, don't you? And more than you, your mind is really, really stubborn. How long have you been trying to get this mind to meditate over the last 6 or 7 days? And it's been so stubborn. Come on, watch your breath. It won't do it. Come on. No. Use force. No way. Come on, just open the door of your heart, mind. What do you want to do, mind? Nothing you want to do. So your mind is incredibly stubborn. Just like the donkey. Actually, the donkey is, you know, just, you know, up there with you. But the mistake is that you see this with owners of donkeys. They get out a stick and they beat the donkey with the stick. Now, that doesn't work. You try and beat the donkey with a stick, the donkey gets more stubborn. That's why willpower never works. Aggression, anger, blame never works. But wise people, they don't use the stick to beat the donkey. They use the stick, they tie it to the back of the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is about 2 feet in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, they tie a rope or a string. On the end of the string, a carrot. In Asia, in Penang, they usually put durian. Because people like durian. I shouldn't have mentioned that word. Now you people from Penang are saying, oh, it's another 2 or 3 days before I can eat durian. Oh, unfair. But anyhow, say you put a carrot in front of this stick, because this is Australia. You put a carrot in front, and then the donkey sees carrot. 2 foot in front. So what the donkey does, it just moves towards the carrot. Now, desire and craving, that's what runs this world. And so that it moves towards the carrot, but because the donkey moves, the stick moves, the string moves, and the carrot moves. So the carrot's always 2 foot in front of the donkey. And he never catches it. Even if it runs, it never catches a carrot. Does that sound like your life? Always pleasure, happiness, fulfillment. You know, it's been very close to you many times. You can see it right in front of you. The perfect relationship, the perfect guy, the perfect girl, the great job, peace, happiness, good health. Sometimes you almost got good health and then you get sick. It's almost there, but you move and it moves away from you. That's life. But donkey comes to Jhana Grove. Donkey hears Dhamma. Donkey learns how to catch carrots. And this is the trick, how the donkeys catch the carrot. First, the donkey runs like hell after the carrot. Really fast. But, as usual, no matter how fast the donkey runs, the carrot's always 2 foot in front. But what he hears in Jhana Grove is the magic four-letter word. The donkey stops. Stops all craving, all trying, all doing, all moving. It stops and is still, the great five-letter word. What happens? That carrot goes further away. Have you tried letting go and your mind goes crazy? You sit there and do nothing and you have more thoughts coming in your head? Exactly, that's what's supposed to happen. Have a bit of faith. You don't know, do you? You get involved. So the carrot, for most of you little donkeys, the carrot goes a little bit further away. They think, oh my God, it's going further away. I better start moving. And you interfere with the process. But the real donkey, the wise donkey, just stands there. And even though the mind is going crazy, doesn't do a thing. Just stands there. Sits there still. Stops, doesn't move. Doesn't react. And soon that carrot is 4 foot in front of the donkey. Never been so far away. Your meditation's never been so bad and crazy ever since then when you come to Jhana Grove and do one of Ajahn Brahm's retreats. Then it really goes all over the place. Great. Because it gets 4 foot in front and the donkey still stands there, perfectly still. And then a strange thing happens. The carrot starts coming towards the donkey. Never done that before. And the donkey doesn't get excited. When things start to happen, you just say, wow, great, marvelous. Keep still, otherwise it doesn't work. And soon that carrot is 2 foot in front of the donkey again. But this time coming faster than ever seen before towards the donkey's mouth. And again, the donkey has to be patient. When you get nimittas, things are happening, don't get excited. Woohoo, way, great, marvelous. You stuff up again. Donkey is perfectly still, never excited. And then it comes so close. A lot of times people don't get enlightened because they've got no metta. It's like the carrot comes into the donkey's mouth and bounces off its teeth and goes out again. That's what happens. So close, but you're stuffed up. Why? Because the real donkey is still, but has got metta, loving kindness. At the right moment, the donkey thinks, the door of my mouth is open. And then the carrot comes straight in. And that is how donkeys catch carrots. And that's how you get enlightened. You actually sit there doing absolutely nothing. You go crazy for a while. Sit there doing nothing. And soon you start getting smart and wise. Things start to happen. You're not doing anything. You're just sitting there. Carrot's coming towards you. It's coming really fast. Nimittas, jhanas. That's neat. But you don't move. At the right moment, take you. Another enlightened being. Now that's very, very accurate. That's how these things work. And it also shows you why people don't get enlightened. Why many people don't get enlightened these days. Because they try too damn hard. They just don't know how to stop and be still. And they do stop and be still a little bit. Now that things start to move and get worse, and they just give up. They don't remain still long enough to really catch the carrot. That is a way to become enlightened. So already, that what happens is when you start to get these carrots, you know, you see that, now the first carrot is seeing the non-self, if you like, or things disappear, or, you know, this thing outside is suffering. And inside as well, you start to see there's nobody in here. That is the essence of the stream winner, seeing non-self. Seeing there's no being in here at all, in any place, in any way whatsoever. And all of this which you take to be me, totally conditioned. It's one of the reasons I don't mind telling bad jokes. Years ago I told a talk to the monks. Madam Ajahn Sujata was there at the time. He recorded it. He gave it the title, Why Ajahn Brahm Tells Bad Jokes. He understood. And the reason was, it's because my father told bad jokes. Because he told bad jokes, it was just conditioned, not my fault. Total brainwash, that's what it was. So I don't take any responsibility. Never did, never will. It's his fault. And if I say anything which is wise and clever, it's nothing to do with me. I take no responsibility either. It's Ajahn Chah's fault. He taught me. He brainwashed me. And Ajahn Mun brainwashed Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Mun's teacher brainwashed him. And the brainwasher in chief was the Buddha. He started all of this. It's his fault. And as you see that, it's absolutely accurate. So there's nobody in here. So if you really see there's no one in here, really see it. Not only you're a stream winner, but it changes the way you look at life. You realize there's nothing really worth preserving. There's no one in here. If you really see the extent of suffering, this body is not worth preserving. Not even this mind. It's just burning, it's suffering, it's pain. You soon see, if you really understand that, the purpose of life is to end rebirth, not to be reborn again. That's why this machine is so profound. There's this whole meaning. Someone's turned it on, it's going to turn itself off. That's what you have to do. Turn yourself off. Can you do that? It's a difficult thing to do, to stop being reborn. But eventually you do. One of the ways to stop being reborn, which you see as a stream winner, why do people get reborn at the end of their life? It's because they want to. They're not finished yet. To stop being reborn at the end of your life, you have to be perfectly still. You move, you get reborn. You're perfectly still, you won't. And you can't even be still now, when you're alive. Can you be still for a few seconds? I mean, really still? There's a movement in the mind. That movement creates rebirth. You are creating. So if you can only sit perfectly still, train that way, and maybe when you die, you'll be that still that the buzz of rebirth will pass you by. And then you won't get reborn again. Bye-bye. But do you want to be... Do you want to end things? Do you really want to end rebirth? A lot of people, we don't. You know why? Because you still think there's somebody in there worth preserving. That stops you being a stream winner. That's why it's very rare to see a stream winner, a real stream winner. Because they haven't really seen non-self. They think they have, but they ain't. To see really there's no one in there, and the result of that, no guilt, no fear. Now, fear actually comes later. Especially the guilt business. Nobody in here, for goodness sake. That's why a stream winner will never get reborn in the lower realms. They don't have the guilt to get reborn in the lower realms. They're free of that. So you become a stream winner. And the great simile of the Buddha was the simile of the, I like this one, the seven shipwrecked sailors. And it gives like perhaps one of the best ideas of the different paths and fruits, the different levels of enlightenment. The seven shipwrecked sailors, again using similes, they used to be seafarers in the time of the Buddha. They went all the way to India, all the way to Aden and through the bottom of the Red Sea to Egypt, in the time of the Buddha. Those sea routes were well established. But of course, in those days, if you went sort of sailing, sometimes a storm would come up and you'd get shipwrecked. So he said there were seven shipwrecked sailors. The first sailor, in the ocean, bobbing up and down, then went down. Bad karma. So it goes down. Second shipwrecked sailor bobs up and down, up and down, up and down. After a while, gets tired and goes down. He hasn't got that bad karma, but still, not enough good karma. The third shipwrecked sailor, he actually keeps ahead above water. So I got it right, third, fourth, fifth. No, there's another one somewhere. I missed that one. Okay. That's right. The third shipwrecked sailor keeps his head above water. He's got enough good karma to float. The fourth shipwrecked sailor is like the third one, only he's got his head above water. He doesn't go sinking. And as he is head above water, he looks around and he can see dry land. Safety. He's not going to drown. He can actually find a place to go to, a refuge. That's like the stream winner. He understands the problem. He can see the solution. There's dry land. That's the stream winner. The fifth shipwrecked sailor is swimming towards the land. They're on their way to safety. That's the Sakadagami, the once returner. The sixth of the shipwrecked sailors. He's so close to land, he doesn't need to swim anymore. He can actually stand up, got solid ground underneath his feet. He's wading through the surf to the shore. That's the once, the non-returner, the anagami. So close to enlightenment, it's hardly much to go. It's, you know, hardly anything at all. And the seventh shipwrecked sailor has made it to dry land. He's sitting under the coconut tree, eating a nice, drink a nice cup of coffee with a biscuit. That's not what it says in the suttas. Sorry, a nice cup of tea with condensed milk and a biscuit. But that's maybe what might happen to me after this talk. So he's made it. She's safe. The last shipwreck sailor. That's the Arahat. And that's a very evocative simile of the passing fruit, because the first passing fruit of, you know, becoming a stream winner, you've actually really seen the Dhamma now. You understand what this Buddhism is all about, what the problem is. To end rebirth, you can actually see how rebirth can end. You know, how suffering can end. You know, you've seen there's nobody in here, so there's nothing to lose. That's one of the reasons why people don't want to end rebirth, because they think they're going to lose. There's no one in here anyway, so what are you bothered about? This is not words. You've got to understand this and see this. And so once you become a stream winner, you've seen the dry land. And obviously, once you become a stream winner, there's no other choice. You've got to start swimming. Swimming to dry land is actually more sort of practice, keeping the Eightfold Path, really keeping your precepts this time, because you really see their importance is getting out of the problem, like getting out of a burning building. Meditating really properly, not for just trying to get rid of your social problems, but you know, really trying to meditate to let go of all desires and cravings and suffering. And sooner or later, certainly sooner or later, you get close to the shore. You've hardly got any more defilements left. All the attachments to the body are all long gone. The only thing you've got left as an anagami is, interestingly, that's where you do have attachment to the jhanas. Attachment to the joy of the jhanas. You're an anagami. To actually let go of that last piece, you just let go of that joy. But as a member of this one Thai monk said, look, that's not the problem of attachment to jhanas. It's attachment to all the other things. That's the problem. You know, I think many people here, they'll be very happy to be an anagami, a non-returner. And that's good enough for this lifetime. Of course you will be. So that's not a big problem, the attachment to the jhanas. It's all the other attachments. Those are the main things. And then, of course, it's such a simple thing to wade ashore and any of the four arahat. No more birth. And sometimes people ask, I asked this in brief yesterday, but isn't that selfish, being an arahat? You know, you're getting out of this world. What about everybody else? And sometimes I bang my head and say, that stupid, look, there's nobody in there. How can you be selfish? It's just cause and effect. It's just what happens. Now, is a banana tree selfish or suicidal? Because when a banana tree gives its bananas, then it dies. It's not selfish. It's not suicidal. It's just its nature. It's the nature of human beings. The idea of being selfish or non-selfish just doesn't apply. It's just those are worldly terms. For people who still think they're here, they've got a self. So that's why when you really understand what's going on here, it's not about selfishness. It's not about anything. This is just what happens. You've got no choice in the matter. As soon as you see all the problem, you swim for the shore. And fortunately, that you tell other people to swim as well. You tell them the way. And so many other people follow you. And that saves lots and lots and lots of shipwrecked sailors from drowning. So that's actually the paths and the fruits. And the result of that, you're an arahat, fully enlightened. But you don't disappear straight away. Spend the rest of your life teaching, getting as many other people out of samsara as quickly as possible. So when you go, lots of people can go after you. And that's always been the way. This is a prison. This world you live in, this body, this mind, it's like a prison cell. And the five walls are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. So high, that's all you really can see. But in your little prison cell, you've made a nice comfortable cell for yourself. Many of you have even actually met another prisoner and married them. And having six or seven other little jailbirds to play around. You know, your cell has got a nice TV in there and it's pretty okay. You get maybe able to travel to other parts of the prison, to China, to London. And your guard, the guard of the prison, what his name is Will. And you think that Will is your best friend. And you don't realize that Will has been torturing you all these years. And then you're in this prison cell for such a long time, and you're born in there, many lifetimes in there. You really actually like prison. You got used to it. You know these people have been institutionalized for such a long time, when their parole comes up, they don't want to leave. That's like a person who doesn't want to get into jhana. They don't want to leave. They got used to this suffering. They'd rather have the suffering of prison than having the beautiful free air of outside. But sooner or later, a few of them give it a try. And actually, when they find there's this little tunnel, there's a tunnel in jail, and it's called the Eightfold Tunnel. But first of all, you need a map, and that map is called Right View. And you have to be so peaceful if you go down that tunnel, because if you start to make any noise, the will find you, the prison guard, and drag you out again. You have to be very kind. Otherwise all those little rats in the tunnel will actually sort of disturb you. And so gentle, so no one hears you. You have to have the three right intentions. And only really good people with right speech, right action, right livelihood can crawl down there. Otherwise, when you get very deep and you can't see anything, you get very afraid. People who have done bad things are always afraid of the dark. It's a bit of guilt comes up. If you've got very, very good sila, that fear doesn't come up. You can go right into that tunnel. But you've got to be very mindful. It's very easy to bang your head on that tunnel. You've got to be very aware. And it's the effort. It's to keep being peaceful, kind and gentle. If you haven't got that type of effort, the tunnel caves in. Sometimes in that tunnel, you've got to be so still. Because you get to places, the more you move, the more you go back. But when you're still, it's like going down this slide. You go deeper and deeper. At the end of the tunnel, you see this beautiful light. The light at the end of the tunnel. The nimittas. You go through the nimittas, into jhana realm. Past the jhanas. And you're outside. Free. Nibbana at last. That's how you escape from jail. But to escape from jail, you've got to realize this is jail, first of all. Otherwise, you'll carry on just decorating your jail cell. Wondering, how can I get some nice new furniture for my jail cell? And getting the IKEA catalogue. How to decorate your jail cell even more. Inviting other members of the jail fraternity, and having a party in your jail cell. All this other stuff, and having football teams in the different parts of the jail cell, and worrying about which team is going to win, which team is going to lose. Not realizing you're in jail all the time. So please, escape. That's what this is all about. And when people come along and tell me, "Oh, you monks, you're just trying to escape from the world." Yes, you've understood at last. Sadhu, 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 you've understood me. Yes, I'm trying to get out of here. So you come along with me. Escape. So that's it for this morning. The paths and the fruits. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay. Now we have some interviews. And those not interviews, please remember, stop.